Your Majesties, Your Royal Highnesses, distinguished members of the Norwegian Nobel Committee, citizens of America, citizens of the world, listener.
Excuse me, Ron, can you say Highnesses on the air?
Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And Ken, I receive this honor with deep gratitude and great humility. It is an award that speaks to our heart.
Ron, no.
Well, you know what I thought? What I thought about the president's speech at the Nobel ceremony in Oslo, Norway? I thought it was nice of him to bring General McChrystal along with him to sit on the stage.
Because it's a peace prize.
Yes.
And I think sending 30,002 troops, because, you know, the Salahis were there, to...
we did that joke last week.
So what? We do it again.
A very somber speech.
I thought the references to Reinhold Niebuhr were particularly deep, and I thought they'd mean a lot to you, because I know you're a big reader of Niebuhr.
Yes, as a matter of fact, it was Leave It to Niebuhr, one of my favorite shows in the 1850s. Wow. So a little contradiction there. President of the United States sending troops.
Right at the beginning of the speech. Right.
We are at war. I'm responsible for the deployment of thousands of young Americans to battle in a distant land. And some will kill. And some will be killed. And so I come here with an acute sense of the costs of armed conflict, filled with difficult questions about the relationship between war and peace and our effort to replace one with the other.
I'm not sure it was pleasing for the Nobel Committee to have this decision made between the time they gave him the award and the time that he accepted it.
And in fairness, President Obama from the outset said that I'm not sure I'm deserving of this award. And
all along he said that. So, and then he made reference to some of the specific people that he had been most affected by, Dr. Martin Luther King in particular, and their use of this particular occasion to give a speech that was a long-lasting, memorable contribution to the literature of, if you will, peace philosophy.
If anybody deserves the Nobel Peace Prize, it's watching no armed conflicts break out between Ambassador Eikenberry and General McChrystal, watching the two of them sit side by side, professing to be good friends during their...
My longtime friend.
And they have been longtime acquaintances.
Back to West Point. But not really ever friends, and certainly not friendly.
Lately.
When Eikenberry came out and said, you know, I really don't think we should be sending any more troops to Afghanistan.
And McChrystal said, let's send 40,000.
So if there's anything that Obama deserves the Nobel Peace Prize for, it's that meeting he had Monday afternoon with these
two men. Keep the two of them from killing each other.
And to then get them out there, as you said, before the Senate and House committees to essentially read off the same page. And they were fairly convincing in saying that they agreed with each other on what our policy ought to be.
One thing that struck me, and is still going back to President Obama's West Point speech. Initially, the speech was supposed to be all things to all people. And of course, when he talked about the timetable for withdrawal, it was McCain and the others who said you're sending a bad signal to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. But what about the talk about withdrawal, which was immediately followed by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and National Security Advisor Jim Jones, who said, look, we're not really talking about a real withdrawal in July of 2011.
Well, this is the thing. You could talk about the day the first guy comes home as opposed to the day the last guy comes home. And that can be years, years different.
So in other words, initially, the West Point speech was supposed to be giving a little bit to everybody, but I'm not sure if the anti-war, the progressives, whatever that movement is called now, got what they wanted to.
I don't think they did at all. No. And I think that they are, in some sense or another, going to have to chew through this speech that the president gave in Oslo and think, do we have a peacenik president here? I don't think we do. We have someone who has embraced the contradictory notion that in order to pursue a more peaceful world, you have to do it through a certain amount of military strength. And that is, generally speaking, not the emphasis that we heard from candidate Obama. He said Afghanistan was a war of necessity as opposed to Iraq, but he never really came out and said, as a candidate, I oppose war in general. I'm against war. He just allowed the peace movement to fix on him and see him as their best chance to have their kind of guy be in the White House and prefer him over Hillary Clinton.
As candidate Obama became President Obama, there were signs, especially in the last couple of months, that the administration realized this war was not going well. And I think the progressive movement in this country got a sense that maybe Obama may be turning away from the rhetoric he had during the campaign and perhaps going toward what perhaps Vice President Biden was talking about, a minimal minimal addition of U.S. troops.
Basically pulling the plug as soon as possible and just, you know, sending in some drones and some special forces and some small teams to try to assassinate al-Qaeda.
And sending 30,000 additional troops was not that signal.
That's right. So in a sense, though, it is possible. And I think the decline of the president's approval numbers under the 50% mark in several polls now tends to indicate that while he is delivering a tough message to one group, let's say the peace group, he is also delivering a somewhat astringent message to the military and to the people who would prefer a much stronger military response in Afghanistan, that he's not with them either. So as he tries to find, as you say, a message to all sides, in a sense, he becomes a partisan of none and the hero of none. And that's part of the reason I think that his numbers are coming down. That, of course, and the nagging unemployment rate.
As the Republicans seem to be pushing or supporting the president's policy in Afghanistan, Democrats are obviously more wary. You don't see much support for the Republicans with anything to do with the economic fixes that the Obama administration has proposed, and they're certainly not on board with health care.
That's right. I mean, we've got the president and the Democrats talking about using some of the leftover TARP funds. This was money for the bank bailout that hasn't been spent, and some of which has been returned.
A lot of it has been repaid.
Quite a bit has been repaid, and more will be repaid. They're talking about using that in part to reduce the deficit and in large part to try to create jobs to address that 10% unemployment rate we've been talking about. And the Republicans are not supportive of that. They think it should all go to deficit reduction. And we also have the Democrats pushing a bill through the House to re-regulate the financial services industry. They're doing that without Republican votes as well. And then we get to health care.
One of the big developments this week was the introduction of the Stupak Amendment in the Senate under the guise of Ben Nelson of Nebraska.
This is the abortion amendment.
The anti-abortion amendment, right? Of course, anybody taking federal subsidies with health care could not do it for abortion. And it failed pretty miserably, but you did have two Republicans voting against.
Pro-choice Republican women.
Just the two of them. Snow and Collins of Maine, and you had seven Democrats, including Nelson, of course, who voted for the Nelson Amendment. Ben Nelson, the conservative, more moderate or centrist, or whatever you want to call him,
Nebraska Democrat.
Right, exactly. He has said that if that language is not in the final bill, he will not vote for it. And again, we keep talking about the Magic 60, and the Democrats ostensibly have that Magic 60. They have the 58 Democrats plus the two independents, but nothing is assured in this. We've said this so many times, the Mary Landrews, the Blanche Lincolns, the Joe Liebermans of the world, we're not sure if Ben Nelson and some other pro-life Democrats, Evan Bayh voted with Ben Nelson, and the two senators from North Dakota voted with Ben Nelson. Anyway, if there's any kind of defections among Senate Democrats, that magic number of 60 doesn't look so promising anymore.
That's right. Senator Harry Reid, the Democratic leader, has to perform some kind of magic trick to get 60 votes together again. But let's just say that he can come up with some sort of compromise language that at least satisfies Ben Nelson and some of these other pro-life Democrats enough to keep them in the tent. The other big issue that was on the table this week was the public option,
right,
which may be getting slid over to one side onto some sort of a sidetrack and replaced by a group of changes that would provide a certain kind of access to insurance to some of the uninsured, possibly involving what some have called baby boomer bait, which is lowering the access age for Medicare all the way down to 55, so that a large number of people who may not have access to any other kind of really good health insurance would suddenly be able to get this wonderful, marvelous government-provided Medicare, or at least pay for it until they're 65, have access to it. And that could be a game changer with respect to getting the bill through without public option and then making a compromise with the House.
Although, if the price tag right now is supposed to be $800 billion over 10 years or something, this would increase the price pretty substantially.
Maybe and maybe not, because there are actually some savings available in the long run by getting people into Medicare sooner. Over the long period of time, we've seen that the sooner people get into Medicare, the sooner their health picture is improved for the length of their life. So that if you could theoretically be giving people the kind of good care they get under Medicare 10 years earlier, they might ultimately require fewer medical services at a lower, more manageable cost. Now, all of that is kind of a projection. It's hard to really see it in terms of reality, but it at least makes it possible that the Congressional Budget Office will smile on this and give it a favorable scoring, in which case the Democrats might be able to bring this off. It's a kind of sleight of hand, I would say. I mean, they're really moving a lot of different programs around here and trying to keep 60 votes together, but that ultimately is probably a tougher knot and a more critical breakthrough point for the Democrats than even the abortion issue.
I haven't seen details, and I'm still trying to look for it, but it seems like the Democrats are more optimistic about passage of this than they were perhaps a week ago.
Yes.
And I'm thinking that certainly before Christmas that Harry Reid could get that vote on the Senate floor.
It's hard to believe. I can scarcely give credit to that notion, but it does appear that that's what more and more of the Democrats are thinking. But that doesn't necessarily improve the overall Democratic expectation for 2010, which still looks like a correction year, if you will, to use stock market terms. It looks like a year when Democrats are going to come down from that huge 60 in the Senate, down from that huge 258 in the House. And we just saw another pretty safe bet for re-election among the Democrats in the House decide to retire.
Yeah, I'm not sure the seat will switch hands, but Brian Baer, the six-term Democrat from the state of Washington who's been there since 1998, has been reelected pretty comfortably ever
60-some
since.
60-some percent
yeah,
last time.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he replaced Linda Smith when she left in 98 to run for the Senate, and he's been winning pretty handily. This is a swing district. I think the Democrats keep it, but again, the Democrats are so wary of the 1994 comparisons, and I think we're so premature to compare 2010 to 1994. But it is the third Democrat who was announced in recent years, Dennis Moore of Kansas, John Tanner of Tennessee, and now it's Brian Baird of Washington. Again, we're only talking about three, but we're also talking about December of 2009. If that number increases, the more and more Democrats get nervous.
That's right. And I think we can say that the one thing that Tanner, Moore, and Baird had in common, three very different members, but three guys who, were they running for re-election, would clearly be favored for re-election. Tanner would be safe. Moore is certainly the strongest Democrat running for the House in the state of Kansas. And Brian Baird would have been considered safe as well. Now all three of those have to be question marks, and I wouldn't be surprised to see at least two of the three go Republican. So those are the openings that can lead to a, if there is going to be any kind of a replay of 1994, that's where we would look for it. On the other hand, things seem to be playing out more or less as expected in the state of Massachusetts.
Exactly. The Massachusetts Senate race primaries were this week, and State Attorney General Martha Coakley, who has held the lead from the moment she got in the race, the only statewide elected official, the only woman in the race, she handily defeated a field of three challengers, including Mike Capuano, the congressman. She had like 47% of the vote, and he had 28% of the vote.
She looked pretty strong.
For Scott Brown, the Republican nominee, for him to win, I guess his best chance was to see a divided Democratic field, a tightly contested primary, some recriminations and some rancor that came out of it, but none of that happened. All of the three challenges to Coakley all endorsed her that night, and so the odds are heavily against Scott Brown, the Republican nominee, winning that Senate seat. Of course, no Republican has won in Massachusetts since Ed Brooke in 1972. For Scott Brown to win, he's going to have to woo independents, he's going to have to woo disaffected Democrats, but I don't see it happening. The Kennedy family seems to coalesce behind Martha Coakley, her Democratic challengers in the
primary. Changes the weather, doesn't it, if the Kennedy family coalesces?
Do not criticize the Kennedy family.
Another statewide race we've all got our eyes on, and I know, Ken, you have your eyes both squarely on this race. Illinois governor, the primary February 2nd.
Oh, my
Ken,
God.
It's practically on top of us.
Pat Quinn, who became governor when Rod Blagojevich was
impeached
and removed from office. Pat Quinn now has a very serious challenge in the February primary from Dan Hines, a three-term state controller. So we always talk about the Republicans fighting each other. We always talk about Kay Bailey Hutchinson and Rick Perry in Texas, those kind of primaries. The Marco Rubio primary against Charlie Crist in Florida. But Democrats seem to have their problems as well, as we're seeing in the Illinois governor's race.
Yes, but let me just read a quick list of some of the Republicans who are also going to be in that February 2nd primary for governor of Illinois. You've got Jim Ryan, a former state attorney general who ran against Blagojevich and lost in 2002, with the golden name, of course, of Ryan, the name of the last Republican governor who is
still in prison.
Jail. And then there are two state senators, Bill Brady and Kirk Dillard. Then there is the former state Republican Party chairman, Andy McKenna, a political consultant named Dan Proft. There is the DuPage County Board chairman, Bob Schillerstrom, and businessman Andy Andruszewski. So they're united.
Yeah. Yes. Also, more gubernatorial news, because I have another goober to talk about. That's right, another goober. Good news in Nevada for Jim Gibbons, embattled Republican incumbent. His approval ratings are up to 19%.
19%.
Maybe it's John Ensign who's helping him move up.
So the national Republican tide has borne Jim Gibbons up near the 20% mark.
Even if it's another tsunami for the Republican Party in 2010, as it was in 1994, there is no way that Jim Gibbons will be reelected, let alone renominated. nominated in Nevada.
You heard it here first. But more good news for another Republican governor this week. The impeachment committee in South Carolina decided not to advance the impeachment of Mark Sanford.
Right. This is a panel of the House Judiciary Committee in South Carolina voted 6-1 against impeaching the governor.
6-1.
And yet all the Republicans have been talking about impeaching him, impeaching him, impeaching him, and here they have an opportunity.
And they vote 6-1 not to.
But I suspect there will be a serious move to censure Sanford, and I know... But which means we will have Mark Sanford to kick around for the next year.
Is that their design? I mean, it seems quite curious to me that they would, after talking so much about impeaching him for so long, miss the one opportunity they had to actually legally go ahead and do it.
In the past 80 years, only two governors have been impeached, Evan Meekum in Arizona
and Rod Blagojevich in Illinois.
And I don't know if, look, whatever Sanford has done, and he's done a lot, I don't know if that rises to the point of that he should be thrown out of office. Some say that he should have the common sense to get up and resign.
Yes, some might say that.
He's clearly not going to do that.
All right, but two mayoral races of interest, one at its final end and one just at its beginning. In Atlanta, we have a new mayor, Kasim Reed.
Former state senator who was an unknown several months ago. He was ahead by 715 votes on December 1st. His challenger, Mary Norwood, demanded a recount because it was within 715 votes. And with the recount, she gained one vote.
So landslide Kasim. Now we move on to New Orleans, where Ray Nagin, one of America's most famous mayors, because, of course, of all the fallout after Katrina, is leaving office because of term limits. And believe it or not, there are at least eight people in New Orleans who would like to be mayor.
Including Mitch Landrieu, lieutenant governor of Louisiana. He is the brother of Senator Mary Landrieu, the son of former mayor Moon Landrieu. This is the third time he's running for mayor. 4 years ago, he ran against Ray Nagin. He's trying once again.
And that's it for this week.
Wait, Ron, I have some good news and bad news to report, actually.
Good news.
Good news is that this week is the birthday of Evie Stone, our producer.
Our sainted producer.
Who comes up with the amazing music. I keep getting email from the listener over and over again. But I have sad news to report from the listener, Mike Levine, who's an NYU graduate student. He says he loves the podcast. He and his friends, and this is what he wrote to us, he and his friends take a shot every time we say Didi Scozafava on the air.
You mean like a flu shot?
The bad news is that we will no longer be saying Didi Scozafava on the air anymore because so he
Didi Scozafava?
Didi Scozafava is not going to be running for Congress. My suspicion is that Didi Scozafava will probably stay in the state legislature. So if they expect to have a shot every time we mention Didi Scozafava, I think they're sadly mistaken.
And that's really it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Reardon.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
Some dirt, dunk a donut for dessert, draw a daisy that's delightful to see when D is handy, it's fine and dandy.